Hello, and welcome to Fade Out, the podcast that examines the final films of Hollywood's brightest lights. Proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network, I'm your host, Rob Kelly. For this episode, our subject is Charles Laughton. Most people who remember Charles Laughton do so as being one of the great actors of the 20th century. Born in 1899, Laughton quickly rose to prominence performing Shakespeare at the Old Vic. That took him to Broadway and then to Hollywood, where he starred in such indelible classics as Mutiny on the Bounty, The Private Life of Henry VIII, for which he won a Best Actor Oscar, The Big Clock, Witness for the Prosecution, Alfred Hitchcock's Jamaica Inn, The Island of Lost Souls, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus, and Advise and Consent. No less than Daniel Day-Lewis said this about Laughton, the actor. Quote, he was probably the greatest film actor who came from that period of time. He had something quite remarkable. His generosity as an actor, he fed himself into that work. As an actor, you cannot take your eyes off him, unquote. As he aged, though, Laughton wanted to move away from acting and into directing. With the help of his longtime friend and producing partner, Paul Gregory, Laughton became a renowned stage director, helming productions of The Caine Mutiny Court Martial and George Bernard Shaw's Don Juan in Hell. Gregory bought the rights to the 1953 novel Night of the Hunter with the intention of it being Laughton's first film as director. Despite the film not being regarded as a masterpiece, its box office failure was so painful to Laughton that he never directed again. Joining me to discuss Night of the Hunter and the all-too-brief career of director Charles Laughton is author and journalist April Snellings. Hi, April.
Hi, Rob.
Thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. It's always fun.
Absolutely. We've been friends for a long time, and I always enjoy getting a chance to do podcasts with you. It's that we never get to really quite do it enough because you're quite busy. I call you author and journalist, but you have about six different other titles that I could have slotted in front of your name there. So I'm just very happy to have you here to be talking about Night of the Hunter. And this is kind of an unusual episode for Fade Out in that most of the time, of course, you know, we examine someone's career through the lens of their final film, but we also talk about their career, their previous films in some, you know, regard or not. This time, except for a little asterisk, which we'll get to, there's just the one movie. Charles Laughton directed one movie, and it just happened to be one of the greatest American films of all time, which is just a remarkable thing to sort of reckon with. Like, you know, the guy one time, and then that he created this classic and then never again. So, but I want to, yeah, you know, there's a lot to talk about, but before we start with all that, let me ask you, where did you first see this movie? When did you first come across it?
So I found the movie, I was in high school, so it's been a minute, but I went through, in high school, I went through a noir phase, okay? And I watched, you know, watched and read about and just consumed every little bit of noir I could find. And somehow that led me, I believe, probably through Mitchum. I think that was how I ended up finding Night of the Hunter. And of course it's a difficult film to categorize. I think of it as a horror movie, but it can easily be viewed as this kind of weird little piece of noir as well. But I saw the film and was just, I didn't even know what to think. You know, when the first time you see this movie, it leaves such an impression. And I was just hooked. I just had to learn about it and see it again and again. And, you know, I felt like I had seen something really special because it wasn't something that was being talked about a lot, except in these little film, you know, kind of film nerd circles. So, yeah, it was just a really special experience. I got to see it later in film school, kind of on the big screen. Somebody had a print and just have never forgotten it. It stayed with me for, God, 25, 30 years now.
I mean, it is fairly unique. I'm guessing when you first saw it is that it's location. You don't see a lot of Southern film noir. You know, absolutely. I mean, there are some titles, but generally it's the urban landscape that they take place in. But here it's got, you know, the Deep South is and again, you know, an unusual choice for British Charles Laughton. You kind of wonder, like, what made him attracted to this? I mean, I mentioned in the intro that it was his producing partner that kind of read the book and thought this would be the, you know, a great thing for this guy, but for Laughton, because he said he wanted to get Laughton kind of out of acting and into directing. But it's a curious choice for Charles Laughton to take of, like, kind of like, what does he know about this part of America? Did he spend any time there? It's kind of amazing.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think Laughton's first reaction when his pal and partner, you know, they were going to do some things together. If I have the story correct in my memory, they were going to do some stuff together. And Gregory got the book, and Lawton was really into it. But he's like, "Who are we going to get to direct this?"
Well, you,
of course,
okay?
Yeah. I had an answer. I said, "Well, you, nobody but you could do this." And at which point, I think Lawton just threw himself into it, you know, just heart and soul.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the screenplay is written by famously the writer James Agee, mm-hmm. and according to different sources, that it was Agee turned in a script that was around 400 pages.
Yeah.
Just completely unshootable. He basically just wrote the book as a screenplay, and he turns it in with like less than, I think, a couple of weeks to shoot. And Lawton realizes, you know, this is unshootable. And he writes it. He rewrites it himself down to what it is, a trim like 95 minutes, which is, again, that's, you know, a remarkable feat to be able to, you know, boil down this script. They hired this big name screenwriter. And he turns in something that's unshootable, and now it's like, oh, geez, I got to rewrite it. But he, you know, he distills it down to its essence.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I've read, I haven't read the entire original screenplay, but what I've read, it's beautiful writing. It's just not a screenplay. he would bring in all these little these peripheral characters who wouldn't even have lines, and he would write a couple of pages about him. About a character who's just like standing there by the river as the kids float by. Or, something just intensely writerly wonderful stuff. But, you know, what do you do with it if you're making a movie? It's useless.
Yeah. Okay. So for anyone who hasn't seen it, I'm going to do a very brief plot synopsis. I'm not going to give away the ending because you should absolutely see this movie if you haven't seen it, but it'll help give us context a little bit of what we're going to be talking about. So it came out on July 26th, 1955. Preacher and serial killer Harry Powell. That's a hell of a combination. Preacher and serial killer Harry Powell is arrested for driving a stolen car and ends up in a cell with Ben Harper, who killed two men while robbing a bank. Powell learns that Ben hid the stolen money and only his two small children know where it is. Harper is executed, and after Powell is released, he visits Harper's tiny rural hometown and charms everyone there, including Ben's widow Willa and her daughter Pearl. The only one who remains skeptical is the older son, John. Powell manages to convince Willa he is there to save her soul, refusing to even consummate their marriage. She even begins preaching alongside him at revivals, but wakes up when she sees Powell threatening Pearl over the location of the money. Powell murders Willa and the two kids escape down the river. Hungry and exhausted, they find their way to the elderly Rachel Cooper, who looks over a small brood of orphaned children. Powell pursues them, leading to a final confrontation between Rachel, the children, and Powell. Robert Mitchum plays Harry Powell. Lillian Gish plays Rachel Cooper. Shelley Winters plays Willa Harper. Billy Chapin is John Harper. Sally Jane Bruce is Pearl Harper. Peter Graves is Ben Harper. Evelyn Varden is the wonderfully named Icy Spoon. Don Pedo plays Walt Spoon. James Gleason plays Uncle Bertie. And as I mentioned, it was written by James Agee, rewritten by Lawton, and based on the book by Davis Grubb. So if you can remember, April, when you first saw it, did you pick up? I mean, it's a weird movie in the best possible way. It looks like a film noir, but then it turns into something else. But I can remember when I first saw it, I think I was probably in my late teens, and I missed a lot of the subtext because I was a dumb kid, you know?
Yeah.
But I thought it worked just as a thriller. Like, if you want to just enjoy it on the level of a thriller, it works on that level. Now, it's got all this other stuff to it. But on the one level, if you just want to watch it as a film noir about an evil guy chasing these children out of money, it works on that level too.
It sure does. Yeah. There are so many movies kind of rolled into one movie there. I think the reason that I connected with it the way I did, and there is a weird kind of local connection. James Agee is from Knoxville, which is where I grew up.
Oh, wow.
Very much a part of Knoxville culture. Like, my high school, one of the buildings was called the Agee Building, and you know, that was kind of where everybody, you know, congregated behind the building to get away from teachers and do whatever they were going to do. But anyway, I think what I kind of picked up on about it was that, and this is a weird thing I think for a teenager to kind of click with, but that fairy tale aspect of it, hit hard with me because I was reading at that time also a lot of stuff about fairy tales and about myth and folklore and that kind of thing. And those two, that's what this movie is, you know, it's this kind of, you know, sort of modern American folklore. It's this really kind of Brothers Grimm, you know, almost Mother Goose story, set against the backdrop of the Depression. And of course, you know, with the great, one of the best villains ever.
Oh, yeah, Robert Mitchum is just amazing in this movie.
Fantastic. So yeah, I think it was just this weird kind of confluence of all these little things that I was into at the time anyway. And then here's this movie that, hello, it's everything. It's all this rolled into one. But that's what I, when I watch the film today, what I see is the fairy tale. I think more than anything, that fairy tale journey that these kids make is what stands out to me more than anything else.
Mitchum said later that, by the way, can you imagine two more disparate kind of people than Robert Mitchum and Charles Laughton?
I know.
But apparently they got along quite well. I mean,
they did.
Laughton, there was quotes from Laughton saying Mitchum sells himself as this kind of dumb guy, but he's not. He's actually highly educated and very literate and very smart, but he sells himself as, you know, this kind of, he's going to punch his way out of a problem kind of thing.
Right.
But Mitchum said later that it was his favorite part that he ever played, mm-hmm. and that Laughton was his favorite director.
And that makes a lot of sense. You know, I think Laughton was a very much an actor kind of guy. I mean, that was his entire life. And I think he was an actor's director too. So it makes sense that, that Mitchum and Shelley Winters had nothing but great things to say about her experience too. I mean, he was apparently just a very supportive guy who was very open to their input, to their ideas. And from the impression, you know, that I get from everyone who's talked about it and written about it, it was a pretty fun shoot.
That's kind of amazing to think, considering the heaviness
I know,
of the subject matter. Although it is very funny.
Funny movie. It's so funny. I know. And that's one of the things that I forget. Like if I go a few years without watching it and then I watch it, I always forget the humor. You know, I always forget that it's a very funny movie. It's dark and it's scary and it's unsettling and it's very, very funny.
The opening scene of Mitchum, where we meet him for the first time, where he's driving in the stolen car and he's talking to himself. He's like, you know, God, I've been, you know, and he's such a clown.
Yeah.
And then even the other scene where he meets Peter Graves in the cell and like he's on the top bunk and we don't know he's there. Mm-hmm. And he lowers himself into the frame and his hair is dangling and Peter Graves just punches him, you know? And so it's like he's this serial killer who is, we already know from the very beginning, has killed multiple people and he kills women specifically. Mm-hmm. And yet he is a big clown. And it's, you know, you watch the film now in 2023 when I saw it many years ago and then I've seen it, you know, in the interval years. And then I rewatch it a couple of times for this recording. And you're like, boy, the guy's such a joke. How do people fall for this? And they were like, well, let's look around in the world we're living in now. Oh, you know, you're like, that's kind of what it is.
The world has helpfully provided us with many contemporary examples of these complete buffoons
who are incredibly dangerous, you know.
Yes,
I mean, it's absolutely. And I thought it's so interesting that Mitchum, when we first meet Mitchum's character and we first meet Harry Powell, he's talking to himself, which means that he on some level believes this nonsense that he's preaching, because he's obviously, if he was by himself, he wouldn't be talking this way, but he really does kind of believe what he says, because when no one's around, he's still talking this way. So this guy completely has internalized the idea that he is a servant of God, and yet it is okay to rob, cheat, steal. He's clearly got, you know, I mean, the running theme of sublimated sex is all through this movie.
Absolutely.
He goes to see the stripper. And he's so mad at her that he sticks a knife through his pocket, like, you know, the most phallic thing imaginable. He's cutting his way through his own jacket.
I mean,
it's and that was all that stuff. I never saw that when I was a kid, the sex part of it. That just blew
that
right
was
by
really
me.
On me. Yeah, I did not pick up on any of that.
As I mentioned in the intro, he refuses to consummate his marriage with Willa, which he is enormously frustrated. And then not only that, he makes her feel bad for her wanting to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, well, she's married this guy. What do you expect? And again, he's got the problem with the stripper. And then you also have the daughter, the oldest daughter of Rachel, the oldest orphan kid, this girl, Ruby, who is desperately looking for maybe not just sex, but certainly romance. And she's kind of trying to get it from these ne'er-do-well guys in the town. Mm-hmm. And Rachel is very understanding. She's like, you know, you're looking for love and you're looking for it the only way you know how. And so mm-hmm. it's like, it's got all of this stuff. And, you know, having read, I read Simon Callow's biography of Charles Laughton. It's called A Difficult Actor. It was published in the late 80s.
Okay.
And I knew from just reading about him or seeing other things that Charles Laughton was gay. Mm-hmm. And he had to hide that. And I'm sure even in the realm of the Hollywood and Broadway, that was more acceptable than it would have been otherwise. But I'm sure it was still very difficult because you're talking, this is the early part of the night. Not that it's, you know, easy now, you know what I mean? But it's
sure, yeah.
that much harder then. And he was, of course, married to Elsa Lanchester
mm-hmm.
for decades. But I have to think this is a guy who had to constantly hide who he was and hide his sexual desires.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a movie about people who are wrestling with their sexual desires in one way or the other. And I think that must have been something that really struck a chord with him, maybe, when he
must
when
have,
he got it.
For sure. Yeah, I read an interesting, I wish I could remember who wrote it, but I read kind of an interesting little critical evaluation of the film a while back that said something about, in a really bizarre kind of way, Harry is, at least in the realm of sex, is kind of the most innocent adult in the the movie, because he's at least honest about, you know, about how he feels about it. And I don't know, man, it's a it's a strange rabbit hole of a movie to kind of go down all these different little, you know, these little paths that Laughton and Davis Grubb, I think, was the novelist.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm sure there were still some vestiges of his script left in there at some point, maybe, perhaps. Mm. But all these little paths that they lay out through the movie go in some really weird places.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that it feels like a kind of like a children's book or like a
For
fable
sure.
in a way.
Yeah.
And part of that is certainly from the fact that a lot of this is shot on sets. Was shot indoors, even scenes where you would naturally think they would be shot outside, when the kids get into the boat and they go down the river.
Yep.
And we meet this, you know, panoply of animals that are bracketing the riverbank.
You meet
like a turtle and rabbits and all these things.
Frog.
And, you know, and all of that is indoors. All of that was shot indoors. And so mm-hmm. it gives the whole thing this bizarre unreality to it. Like it is, like it's a dark children's book, because they, I mean, obviously, you know, Robert Mitchum is our main character because he's Robert Mitchum, but really the story is told through John's eyes. He's the only one that sees through this guy from the very beginning. And mm-hmm. it's really him that we're following, because he's the one who knows where the money is.
Mm-hmm.
And even Pearl doesn't even know where the money is. And Robert Mitchum is constantly trying to get it from, but it's really from John's point of view. And so we see the world through his eyes mm-hmm. in a really strange way. And it has this wonderful, again, it's unreality that is really interesting and unique.
For sure. And it's kind of John's coming of age story, really. He's in a very different place, you know, by the time things play out, than he is at the beginning. He's, you know, he goes through it. And I'm kind of dancing around what I want to say, because I don't want to spoil the ending for anyone who hasn't seen it. I didn't worry much about spoiling Citizen Kane when we talked about that, but I feel like there are probably people who haven't seen this film who, you know, have something really great in store for them. But speaking of that fairy tale look, you know, the movie has two very different looks. The scenes that are more from the kids' perspective have that fairy tale look to them. But the scenes that are a little bit more grounded in the adult perspective don't really look that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have a more traditional kind of a look that I think would have been a bit more expected in 1955.
Yes. And part of it is, too, the look of it is like there were certain parts where the indoors
mm-hmm.
is like there are indoor sets where like giant chunks of the frame are blocked off.
Yes.
And they're just simply darkness.
Yes.
Like the scene of Robert Mitchum and Shelley Winters upstairs when he's about to, you know, about to do her in. And yeah. We just see, and there's just this marvelous skylight coming in, and he's mm-hmm. reaching up to heaven, and it's got this A-frame, and all of the rest of the frame is just complete black. And all we're looking at is the room that yes. they're in. Like it's yeah. a dollhouse. Like it's this weird ass dollhouse. And there's a lot of scenes like that. And again, it just gives it this, again, like this now that's not from John's perspective. That's an adult perspective, but it has such a distinct look to it.
It does. You know, Lawton knew art. He knew it very, very well. And he was certainly somebody who composed shots, you know, like paintings. And God, it's just one of the great creative tragedies, I think, of cinema, is that he only did one film.
Well, that's okay. We'll get back to that, but that's a perfect time to talk about our asterisk.
Yeah.
Because as I mentioned, Charles Lawton, yeah, this is his only film as director, but it is his only film as the credited director.
Right.
There is another movie from 1949 called The Man on the Eiffel Tower, and it's a thriller. It's kind of a comedy thriller, lighthearted thriller, I would say. Shot in color, which is unique for 1949, but it stars Charles Lawton, Burgess Meredith, and Francois Tone. And the director that they hired to Francois Tone, it was apparently produced by Francois Tone's production company. So they hired this director, and pretty soon into the movie, they don't like what this guy's doing. They think he's mm-hmm. terrible. And Francois Tone fires him. He had the power to do that. And they fire this guy off the movie. And so they decide to have a very unique take on how to direct this movie where Charles Lawton agrees, I will direct all the scenes that I'm not in, but Burgess Meredith is in, and then Burgess Meredith will do the reverse. And yeah. so the movie is directed by a couple of different people, and then it finally gets credited to Burgess Meredith. But Lawton yeah. directed apparently chunks at the beginning and chunks at the end. Now you watch this movie too, right?
Yes, and it's so obviously directed by two different people.
How so? Now, why do you say that?
I just feel like the scenes that Lawton directs, I think that they just look and feel entirely different than the scenes that, and maybe it's because I knew that going in, but to me, it's just a profoundly, you know, it's a bit jarring because his scenes are, he's there's a lot going on, right? He's doing a lot of pretty interesting stuff that sort of anticipates, I think, what he would do, what was it, 6 years later with the Hunter. But whereas the scenes that Meredith directed, did the original director do anything? Like, did he actually get to make any of this film?
As far as I understand, he did a little bit, but I mean, bit. I don't really know. I mean, again, back then they made movies in like 4 weeks.
Sure.
So I mean, you know, I mean, the guy works for how long? A couple of days. Well, that's out of a 4 week movie, yep. that's a percentage of the film. Right. Not like nowadays, where they shoot for 8 months, you know, or whatever.
Right. But yeah, I think that I think Lawton's scenes are just super stylish, you know, and the other scenes are a little bit more kind of a little more traditional, you know, a little less flashy, a little less. But yeah, it's not a great movie, you know.
It's
really remarkable about the movie.
It's weird. It's a weird movie. You know, it's like, as I mentioned, it's in color just by that itself for 1949 for not being like a musical.
Yeah,
is kind of strange. The scene where Burgess Meredith discovers these dead bodies.
Yeah,
that's Lawton all over because it's draped in shadow and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's got, you know, it definitely has that sort of feel to it. You're right. Would I know, had I not known going in, that it's directed by different people? I don't know. Yeah. But tonally, it's very, very, you know, there's a right at the beginning, there's a guy who sits down in this little cafe, a French cafe, with his wife and his mistress. And they just have this conversation where mm-hmm. they're all very open about what's happening. It's like, this is really, really an odd.
Yeah, so.
Okay, all right. And it's fun to watch Charles Lawton playing a detective run around the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, for sure.
The stuff at the end is amazing. There's a stunt where they're chasing Francois Tone that I'm like, how did they do that? That guy's really dangling from the
yeah.
Eiffel Tower.
Oh, yeah.
God. But yes, so he's uncredited. So, I mean, you know, yeah, he got a little bit of experience directing film for that film before he moves on to Night of the Hunter. But his cinematographer on Man of the Eiffel Tower would end up being his cinematographer for Night of the Hunter. And this is Lawton's great collaborator, which is the cinematographer Stanley Cortez, who was one of these geniuses. Mm-hmm. He worked with Orson Welles on The Magnificent Ambersons. He did Shock Corridor. He also worked with Charles Laughton on, of all things, Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. Which, just, Cortez was like, I need a job. You know what? I'll just like this Abbott and Costello movie. But yes, Charles Laughton, Mr. Shakespeare himself, was a big fan of Abbott and Costello. So, I mean, you know, I am too. So it was okay. But anyway, he works with Cortez, who just was an absolute genius cinematographer. And there's a quote from him in the Simon Callow book where Cortez says, of all the directors I ever worked with, only two of them truly understood what could be done with light: Orson Welles and Charles Laughton.
Wow.
I mean, that is a hell of a pull quote to say sure. about Charles Laughton.
Wow. And, you know, he was such a student of silent films. And, you know, silent films, just for obvious reasons, they looked amazing, right? They just looked so good for technical reasons and artistic reasons. But he really went in and studied. I mean, didn't just watch, but studied the great silence before he made Night of the Hunter. And man, does it show.
Yeah, it is an absolutely stunning looking movie. I mean, the dark darks and the light lights. There's a scene where they're at like a picnic.
Yeah.
And the two characters are talking in the foreground, and in the background are the kids. And the kids are in white clothes. And the entire, even though he's outside, so I mean, you can have limitations of how much light. It's a bright, mm-hmm. sunny day during the scene. Right. You know, you can only do so much with the light, but yet the entire frame is different values of gray, except the two kids who are in the center of the frame, and they are bright white. Mm-hmm. And it's like, how did he do that? And the kids aren't still. It's right. not like they're running, they're being kids. They're running around, they're wrestling. And I'm like, how did he manage to keep that bright, like angelic light on these two kids in the middle of this bright day and keep everybody yeah. else in the slight shadow? Like, that's amazing.
It really is. And speaking of the weather, I think I read that he just refused to shoot on a cloudy day because, you know, light was so important in this film, and he wanted everything to be so crisp and so sharp. You know, again, like the silence that he was kind of emulating to some extent, and he just wouldn't shoot on a cloudy day. And I think that's awesome.
That's amazing if you can pull that off. You know, right. if you have the pull to say that, good yeah. for you, man.
Yeah, for sure.
Now, you mentioned silent films, and you know, there is an absolute direct connection, obviously, with Lillian Gish yeah. playing this role. Now, Lillian Gish, you know, one of the great silent stars of all time. Now, she kept working through the 30s into the talkie era, the 30s and 40s. She was in some, you know, notable films in the late 40s, but by the early 50s, she had pretty much just been kind of relegated to television. And apparently, mm-hmm. when Laughton came, he watched every D.W. Griffith movie, every single right. one, apparently. Right. Yep. But when he goes to Lillian Gish, she apparently even said to him, why do you want me for this? You yeah. know, I think she was yeah. sort of like, well, you know, I've been out of work for a little while. And he said, yeah. the quote is, you know, my darling, in the old days of the silent films, the audiences leaned forward. Nowadays, they lay back and they munch their popcorn and they drink their soda. I want them to lean forward again.
I love that. It gives me chills. I just think that's I love that.
And he uses some silent film techniques. There's like irises and yep. things, you know, the
which
camera
hadn't been done in I don't know how long.
Right. Exactly. Right? And so
it's an absolute thing that you just didn't do anymore. And yeah.
How familiar are you with silent films? Because I will admit that is the one genre, it's not a genre, but it's the one sort of era of filmmaking that I'm catching up on. I've seen tons of lots of other stuff, but silence, I'm still kind of a little bit behind.
Yeah, it's definitely kind of one for me as well. I'm familiar with, and of course have seen the ones that you just have to have seen, right? Mm-hmm. If you have any kind of formal film education at all, like the ones that you just don't get you can't not watch. So I've seen those, and I've explored it a little. I'm absolutely captivated by it, but it's one of those things that, you know, there's only so many days in the week and yeah. so many days in the day. It's I have not gotten to explore that. I have a friend, a writer named Kelly Robinson, who is an absolute expert in silent films, and I keep wanting to go to some of her programs and to just make her teach me and show me the things that she loves. So maybe someday I'll get to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I said I've done a couple shows this year on people from the silent era, and that's given me a chance to catch up on some of these films. And I'm relatively unfamiliar with Lillian Gish outside of knowing who she is, but I don't think I've only seen like maybe one or two of her films. She's amazing in this. She's this pillar of strength. And you know, it's sort of funny, like these kids get in the boat, right? I mean, and by the way, we can sort of spoil the ending. This movie is 65.
Well, that's true. Yeah, there is
60,
that.
all 60 years old. I think
Yeah.
we're
All
okay.
right, cool. Cool.
Or
Let's leave it there. Okay.
but I mean, these kids get in the boat and like they're, you know, they go down this river and they end up at Rachel's place, and she has just taken in all of these orphans. And you're like, well, these kids just live with her? Are there
Yeah.
not
Yeah.
social services? Like these
You're
kids can
right.
just live there. And you're like, okay. And then she goes into the town, and you know, there's all these wonderful scenes where she's walking and they're all walking behind her in a line like a mother duck and her ducklings. And but she's this old lady, and you would think, well, you know, she's squaring up against Robert Mitchum, and yet she is this power, this pillar of strength. It's an amazing performance by her.
Oh, it's incredible. And the moment, I mean, she is the only adult who sees right through him immediately. You know, nothing in his little bag of tricks works on her. She sees him for what he is right off the bat, and that's a great moment. You know, and then she pulls the shotgun, right? That's one of her first big moments, right? With him is to stick a shotgun in his face. I love it.
And then she just sits on the porch all night with that
Oh my
shotgun.
God. That's one of my favorite scenes, I think, in any movie ever. Just it's incredible. And he's singing, and then she takes a song, and God, I mean, what it just it's chilling, it's beautiful, it's terrifying. It's and how do you not just love that character? You know, how do you not just love Rachel? She's
And
great.
it's funny that Harry initially, if they, he tries to charm her, you know, he does the whole sweet talking thing, hello ma'am, and all, you know, and yet, you know, she, again, as you said, she sees right through it and then shoots at him, you know? And then he ends up holding up in the barn, you know, like a wounded animal, and he's yelling, calling out to her, and she's just like rocking back and forth, like, okay.
It's incredible. I love how he just gets his ass kicked all through the movie, I mean, he keeps going, but you know, he just gets it from all sides. It's pretty great. And I love that when it happens, he just goes feral. You know, like Mitchum just growls and howls, and he's just this creature, you know, in these moments when he's kind of stripped bare of this persona that he's built for himself.
I love the moment where he asks the kid where the kids where the money is, and they lie to him and say it's basically buried in the this pile of coal down in the basement. And they're leading him down there, and then they kind of double cross him and run up the stairs. And again, it's another one of these sets that's all blocked off where we're just seeing the stairwell, the light coming from the top of the stairwell, and then just a little bit of coal. And he starts chasing them, and he falls. He back gets his head bonked, and he looks like Frankenstein
He
at
does. He's
that
got his
point.
arms outspread. Yeah, he does.
And then he falls on the stairwell and like bumps his face. And again, it's very clownish, but it also is very frightening because he knows at that point Willa is gone. And if he grabs those kids, he's going to kill them, as we know. It's frightening very much that Pearl doesn't ever really pick up on it. Like she
No,
likes
she
him.
doesn't. Yeah. She will go right to him. It's like, come on, kid. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
And
she's the younger one,
that
but
makes
still.
it even scarier, you know?
What do you make of the town
Oh,
that he comes
the
in and shows up? Because I mentioned you've got these the these this older couple that runs the ice cream store,
town.
and Walt and Icy, again, what a character name, Icy
Icy Spoon,
Spoon, for a character that works in an ice cream shop.
I know.
but Evelyn Vardon, who plays Icy Spoon, just is in love with Harry. Loves him and buys every bullshit story that he's selling. And I love that the husband is a little like, I don't know. And then, you know, Harry tells some story about where Willa disappeared to. Well, she got up and left. And he's a little like, I don't know. And I love that the town completely is in love with him. And then when he's revealed to be what he is, they turn into a murderous mob again, like out of Frankenstein. They've literally got pitchforks and torches chasing
him. Yep. But they have enabled him all up until that point, you know, maybe not entirely willingly, but, and again, I don't want to, you know, there are certain roads. I don't want to drag this down.
But, oh no, let's do it. Let's go down these roads. Come on.
We've seen, you know, very recently how easy it is for, people to be taken in by something that is so obviously, you know, just an act, and a really bad act at that, you know. And it's a matter of what was going on with them beforehand. You know, why were they so, you know, why was it that were they such easy marks for him to begin with? You know, these and of course that also leads into the whole idea of manipulation via religion and all this other stuff that's kind of going on, you know, both in the text of the film and the subtext. You know, there's certainly a reason that he comes in the guise of a preacher, and he's, you know, the film is just full of hymns and Bible verses, and, you know, it's just steeped in that kind of Protestant, you know, sort of religious conservatism, I guess, that that sort of makes it even easier for him to do what he does.
I'm trying to think, do we even meet any other religious figures in the town? Right. Are there any, or is it kind of,
well, there's the revival, right?
Right.
So, you know, so he's, there's certainly willing subjects, right?
Right. But is there like another religious leader or not? Is that there's this void and he inserts himself in it, and then that's why they're so willing to, you know, but I mean, he tells this story, by the way, this film, one of the legacies of this film is the, I don't know whose decision this was, or whether it was in the book or the script, but Mitchum's character has love and hate tattooed on his knuckles. And he does this thing where they're fighting, and he's got his hands mixed. And, you know, that has lasted into modern day. I mean, in Do the Right Thing, right. Spike Lee's masterpiece, Radio Raheem has rings that say love and hate on them. And there's a Bruce Springsteen song called Cautious Man, where a character has love and fear tattooed on his knuckles. So, I mean, this is like a little thing that has, you know, and that image of him with the words on his hand is like one of the famous images from the film. So that's kind of lived on beyond the movie. But yeah, he really, it's kind of amazing how much he's able to bamboozle everybody, but they want to be bamboozled.
Exactly.
I mean, marries Willa, and she wants, as I mentioned, she wants to consummate their marriage, and he rejects her cruelly. And instead of her turning against him, she kind of sublimates herself even further and becomes his kind of co-preacher at these revivals. And you're like, God, she's completely emptied out as a person, and he's just manipulating her from the get-go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, it's something else that just ramps up the kind of, at least early on, the tragedy with the kids is every adult, until they meet Rachel, every adult in their life just fails them in, you know, really spectacular ways. Not that Willa isn't a victim, because she is, but she also,
she doesn't look out for her kids.
Entirely not complicit, you know,
she hands her kids over basically to this guy. There's another great scene, again, beautiful scene setting of where John and Harry are. Harry's confronting John in this hallway, and he's kind of threatening. He's not saying anything too out of line, but you know that he's using his body language. Obviously, he's looming over this kid, and they're in this hallway of the house, which is absurdly narrow. I mean, you could barely slide two people across it. And he's leaning over this kid, and, you know, he was constantly kind of inserting, like, hey, you know, you want to help me? You want to, you know, help your mother? And by the way, just as a side road, Shelley Winters, right?
Yeah.
I grew up with Shelley Winters as that kind of slightly tipsy lady who would come on Johnny Carson and just tell stories. And they made fun of her on Saturday Night Live. And I will admit, I was kind of like, oh, she's just kind of like this old lady who's a little out of control. I didn't know about her films. You go back and look at her filmography. Wow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, you know, you know, she, A Place in the Sun, He Ran All the Way, The Poseidon Adventure, Stanley Kubrick's Lolita. I mean, this film, I mean, like, you know, she brought it and she's great.
For sure.
You know,
she is.
The scene where she kind of accepts the idea that he's going to murder her.
Yeah.
But she's just laying there in the bed. I mean, what do you think that is?
What's going to happen? Yeah. And she knows. She has to know, right? You know, it's very clear at that point what's going to happen. And what a remarkable scene, right?
Yeah. At that point, she's found the knife in his pocket. So she knows what's going on.
Yeah. And the revival, I mean, her face during that revival scene is just something else.
What do you think that is? Why is she willing to, like, be murdered by the guy, you know? God, like, what's wrong with her?
I ask myself that a lot about people who seem so, like, I want to be careful what I say, but, you know, there do seem to be a lot of people who are very happy to participate in their own, you know, their own downfall in some really, really horrible situations. And you just wonder, man, what, and it's an odd, when you consider her relationship with Ben, who, you know, you get, of course, he's in prison, you know, from the get-go, and you don't really see any of this, but the impression you get is that it was healthy-ish, as healthy as it can be.
You're married to a bank robber who's killing people,
guys in a bank robbery. But you get he definitely was not like Harry, right? He was I don't think he intended to kill anybody, right? Is that addressed, or is that kind of just implied?
I don't know if they really quite get to that, but you don't get the sense that when he's in jail, he's desperately worried about his children. Now you could argue, well, don't do what you did, but you don't get the sense he's just like a brutal killer who doesn't care about what he feels bad for what he's done, and that he's going to leave his kids and his wife in a bad way.
Right, and you wonder, how does she go from the kind of marriage that she supposedly, it's kind of implied that she had with Ben? Why does she so readily accept Harry?
I mean, part of it might be that the town is letting her know that it's sort of like not socially acceptable there to be a single woman. In fact, Icy Spoon really gives it to her. Mm-hmm. She's kind of talking about, well, you need a man. And Willa's just kind of like bored, scooping the ice cream. Like, kind of like, you just leave me alone. Can I just sit here and scoop the ice cream? Do I have to get a lecture from you, you know, about my life? I mean, I'm a widow, for Pete's sakes, you know, but it's not like she's, you know, horror of horrors, divorced or anything. And then, you know, the scene where she is, you know, Harry kills her. And then there's a scene where this friend of John's named Uncle Bertie, who's a kind of like town drunk, but is nice to the kids, finds her body.
Yeah.
And it is really one of the most, you know, simultaneously horrible because it's this dead body, but also beautiful images.
It is
in all of film noir. Her, she looks like kind of, again, like angelic. She's bathed in white, but this body is floating. Because he put it in a car and dropped it into the lake, and it's stunning how beautiful it is, and just very poetic.
The hair is kind of drifting with the seagrass and what is it when it's in a river? What is it called?
Is it not just seaweed? Is it something else?
Seaweed, but yeah,
I don't know.
It's just kind of drifting there with her hair, and of course it's they used a mannequin with just a really good mask, right? Just a really great,
stunning. When you watch it, you're like, wow, how did Shelley Winters hold her breath that long?
I know. That was my thought, too. I know, for the longest time, I thought it was really her. And I was like, damn, girl, that's amazing. How did she do that?
Good stuff. Yeah. Oh, it's absolutely just beautiful. Now, I was surprised to learn, again, in the book I read, that Lawton didn't really have a great relationship with the two kid actors, Billy Chapin and Sarah Jane. Of course, he didn't like them a whole lot, which is stunning. You would think that he managed
to. He really didn't like the girl. It was the little girl that really got his goat. He He did not have good things to say about her. I think the boy he got along with was fairly well, but the little girl he just didn't like at all.
That's fine. That seems remarkable. And we've all heard stories about actors, or excuse me, directors that are really good with children, like Spielberg, you know, is really good with children, which is why he's been able to sort of coax really good performances. And I think it's interesting that both these kids really didn't have any other career in Hollywood after this. Sally Jane Bruce literally has no other credits. She has she did a short before this, and after this, she just did not continue into acting, and apparently she's a teacher now. And then Billy Chapin did some films beforehand. He's in There's No Business Like Show Business. He's in a great little color noir called Violent Saturday, which I actually enjoyed quite a bit when I watched it for the Sylvia Sidney episode that we did a couple of months ago. But him too, he basically never became, and you know, never went on to much of an acting career. So it's kind of, again, these all, you know, to do one thing and it'd be a masterpiece and it never again just seems to defy the way we think of how this stuff works. Like, wouldn't just keep, you know, like you wouldn't get some jobs after being in this movie.
For sure. Yeah. I read I think it was Mitchum who told the story. He, and this doesn't relate to why they just kind of disappeared from acting, but it makes me laugh. apparently there was a lot of drinking going on the set. not often. But Mitchum and Shelley Winters would you know, just sneak off and drink apparently quite a bit, and a lot of the crew. And there was, of course, somebody there from child welfare to kind of monitor things. And she kept catching them and she kept threatening to report them. And at one point they caught her behind the bush drinking. And called her on it, and then the threats to turn them in just stopped, and everything was fine. as fine as lots of day drinking around kids can be, I guess. But you know, whatever.
I guess so. I mean, again, it sounded like everyone understood. Like it was a fun shoot. Again, despite the heavy subject matter, and Lawton had a good time, and he really got along well with Mitchum. And you know, relatively well with Shelley Winters. And so, and, you know, I've mentioned this in other episodes where I think that people who are just fans of movies and live outside that world and don't have any access to the inner workings of it, we don't regard movies that failed financially. We don't regard them any differently than any other movie. You know, we look at somebody's filmography. We just go, that's a good one. That's a good one. That one's not so good, but that's a good one. And whether they made money is lost to the mists of time. It doesn't matter anymore. Yeah. But to the people that make these things, when one of them fails, by the box office, let's not talk about creatively, box office, it's devastating. I mean, it is soul crushing. Mm-hmm. And there's this great story, again, I found in the Simon Callow book, where Lawton was doing a stage play when he was younger, like in his 20s, and I'm blanking on the name of the show, but it got great reviews. The critics said it was fantastic and Lawton is great at it, but it was a flop. Nobody came, like literally empty halls, and it crushed Lawton's soul. And the view was, they said, well, if the show you're in is bad, you can't blame people for not coming, but when the show is good and they're still not coming, that means they don't like you. And he just internalized that. And everyone, critic-wise, said this is a great movie. And it just died at the box office. And Lawton, now, I initially thought, well, that meant that, you know, that he just gave up. Well, that's apparently not exactly true, is that Paul Gregory wanted to keep trying to get him work. And he actually, they moved on to an adaptation of The Naked and the Dead. And they gave Lawton actually hired the same team who did the second unit work for this film, these two brothers, and they went to some island somewhere and worked on it. And Lawton just dragged his feet and apparently turned in a script, like much like a James A.G.
Ironically, after coming down on James A.G. so much, he did the same. He turned in this massive script and then told him that he needed another year or something like that to
The backers said no, this is, and he left the project. And at that point he actually fired Paul Gregory. And they never worked again. They never worked together again. Lawton never directed another movie. Gregory went on to produce other things, but that was it. Now, Lawton didn't live a whole lot longer after this. He passed away in 1962.
Just six, 7 years, yeah.
But nevertheless, I mean, he went, he lived the rest of his life with like, no, that's going to be the one film. And if I, again, I found another amazing quote that apparently they showed this film. I don't know how much of it, I don't know if it was completed or in the stages of completion, but they showed this film to both Billy Wilder and Francois Truffaut.
Okay.
And both of them said, it's great, but this should not be your first film. Because it's very uncommercial. And there's a quote from Truffaut. The film runs counter to the rules of commercialism. It will probably be Lawton's single experience as a director.
Oh, wow. I have never read that, really.
Right on the money there, Francois.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Know, it's just, it's heartbreaking when you think that a guy this capable of creating, and Cahiers du Cinéma called it the second greatest American film ever made after Citizen Kane. I mean, he's the Harper Lee of films, you know,
sure.
Like the one thing.
Yeah.
Brilliant and timeless.
Do you think of, so a couple of things are blamed, right, for the film's complete financial failure. One, the studio just had no idea how to market it. Like no clue, right? Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is just the movie was so out of step with what people were interested in watching in 1955 in America, mm-hmm. right? It's just if you look at the list of other films that were released that year, they weren't like Night of the Hunter, right? So what's your take on it? Do you think it was a combination of those things? Do you think there's something else going on too that we don't talk about as much?
I would imagine that it was well, you know what, it's funny, this is kind of going back to something that I mentioned right at the top of the show, is that when I was working at a video store, as I talk about a lot, I worked at Movies Unlimited, and we had everything, and that's when I sent myself to unofficial film school, because I was like, all right, I want to see everything. There were some films that I knew about, had never seen, that were so regarded as masterpieces that I think I stayed away from them because I was like, oh, are they homework? You know, are they this, are they that? And this was one of those films. And then I just watched it and I went, oh, this is just, I mean, like I said, I missed a lot of the subtext when I was younger and that I see later on, but I was like, this is just a great thriller. And sometimes I wonder, I mean, I'm sure they weren't selling it like this in 1955, but I wonder later on, it's kind of like when Citizen Kane, you know, gets tagged with the greatest film of all time. People go into it with that grudge, like, oh, really?
Yeah.
And it shouldn't, it's just really entertaining. And so to me, Night of the Hunter has, yes, it is weird, right? It has, you know, weird humor and it has some very, you know, some themes that are tough to wrestle with. But if you just want to watch it as a crime thriller with some great performances, it's all of that. And sometimes I wonder, should they have just sold it as a thriller? And if you want to see the subtext, it's there for you. But if you don't, you're just getting a good crime story that's running 95 minutes.
Yeah, for sure. But I don't know. Have you ever seen the Saul Bass? I think he did a poster for it that never got used. And I haven't seen
it.
Yeah. Apparently it's just kind of got buried in somewhere in the archives at the Academy, maybe, but it's not even online. It says, when you try to find it, it says something like digital image available in this other collection. And then you go to this other collection and I couldn't find it there either. But
wow.
I read the description of it and it sounds pretty fantastic. It's an arm kind of coming down from the top of the frame and it's clutching this rag doll by the neck. And it sounds to me like he just summed up the feel of the movie.
Yeah.
In one image, and you just think, what if they had used that image? I mean, maybe it would have been something as simple as showing people what the movie was, because none of the marketing materials really give you any idea, you know, what the movie was. Everything was there was kind of this confusion of messaging, and you know, were they trying to sell it as a horror movie, as a thriller, as a, you know, was it this or that? And you know, which even the reviews at the time were you know, it got some very positive reviews. I think that's one of those kind of myths that go along with this movie is something that I heard a lot is that it would just critically panned when it came out. And that's not the case. I mean, you know, it got some very favorable reviews. not all of them, of course, but it did get a lot of positive stuff out there from critics, and they weren't even quite sure how to write about it. They some reviews call it a horror movie, and write, you know, they're definitely reviewing a horror movie, and then others are reviewing this crime, like it's almost like they watched a different movie, right? In the way that the language that they're using and the way that they talk about it. The one critique that in the reviews that I've read that I see a lot of, which makes me laugh because it's kind of the thing that we love about it, is people talk about how over-directed it is and how the imagery is just so over the top, and it's just, it just clubs you over the head with the symbolism and the kind of the visual poetry of the of his vision, which is,
God forbid a movie have visual poetry.
Right.
Why
would you want to see gorgeous images that tell the story? What was it, cinema or something? Yeah.
Is this a collection of images and sound? I mean, what are we doing here? Oh my God. Yeah, I think people with the best of intentions, want to label it as something, and it's this masterpiece, but I think that scares some people away. And again, it shouldn't. I think this is actually a very accessible movie
it's just very entertaining, even if you want to look at it anything besides just this kind of ripping story about this crazy preacher who's chasing two kids through West Virginia and whatever. I mean, it's watch it for that, and it's a great movie. It's entertaining, it's scary, it's funny, it's I mean, come on.
Yeah. It is just so tragic that Charles Laughton never got a chance to do anything else. I mean, he might be, maybe he'd kept working with Stanley Cortez or whatever, but if you're only going to do one, I get
this pretty good one. Yep.
Pretty good one. Make one of the greatest films of all time. So, I mean, at least there was that. Yeah. So, So anybody, anybody listening to this, if you haven't seen Night of the Hunter, go check it out. It's on the Criterion Collection. It's available on different, I think, you can rent it on streaming and stuff like that. It is just an absolutely beautiful movie. And I had so much fun rewatching and listening to the commentary tracks and reading about it. So I am so glad that this was what you wanted to do, April. So thank you so much for doing this.
Well, you're very welcome. Thank you for having me. It's always fun. It's funny. I think the only time, and you and I, we interact a lot, but the only time we get to talk, like actual conversation, is when we're doing these podcasts. So I'm always happy to get some Rob time to talk about movies. It's fun.
Thank you. I think the last time we podcasted together, we talked about The Lost Boys. So you're a Renaissance woman, April.
Right.
Lots of different stuff. So why don't you tell people where they can find you out on the internet?
Oh, yeah, you can see me at aprilsnellings.com. I occasionally update my website more often than not, I forget. I have a few projects, though, coming out soon that I think are pretty fun. I'm working on something in the horror realm that I'm excited about. And I've got a comic, kind of a weird comic project that is floating up to the surface here soon. And I think it's going to be available. So, a lot of cool things coming out.
Very cool. Yeah, you are always busy with multiple projects. As I said, you're a multi-hyphenate. The different things that you do.
Yeah, whatever it takes, right?
Absolutely. So, again, thank you so much for doing this. I really appreciate it. And speaking of paying the bills, everybody, I want to mention, of course, you can find the show on Twitter at Fade Out Pod. You can subscribe to it in any podcatcher of your choice. All the back episodes are on our website, finewaterpodcast.com. If you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, of which Fade Out is a part, just go to patreon.com/FW podcasts. And there you can get various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big thanks to Monique D for her support of the Fade Out Podcast. So anyway, again, talking about bills, one of the things that I do on as a side hustle, as it were, in the modern parlance, is I have started doing audio commentaries for Blu-rays, movies on DVD and Blu-ray. This has been something I have been wanting to do ever since I bought my first Blu-ray or DVD. 30 years ago, that old, 25 years ago at this point. And now I have finally gotten a chance to do a couple of them. And the first one I did is a 1970 caper film called The Gamblers, which is out now. But coming out in December, I did the audio commentary for a 1959 horror film called Horrors of the Black Museum, starring Michael Goff. Yeah, with Michael Goff, of course, played Alfred the Butler from the Batman movies, and I did the comic art, and I also did the flip cover. There's a brand new cover, and I did the front cover design for that. It comes with the classic poster, but then you can flip it over, and you can see my artwork. So anyway, I am running a contest that you can win a copy of Horrors of the Black Museum on Blu-ray. It's from VCI Entertainment. They were nice enough to provide me a copy for this contest. So all you have to do to be entered into the drawing is go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review for Fade Out. It really does help with so many movie podcasts out there. It really helps. Every review helps the show get noticed. And so all you have to do, again, go to Apple Podcasts, leave a 5-star review, and that enters you in the drawing. And I will pick one name at random, and you will win a Blu-ray copy of Horrors of the Black Museum. It comes out on December 12th. So if you want to win a copy of Horrors of the Black Museum, you want to support the show, just go to applepodcast.com and leave a 5-star review. I really would appreciate it. And I will announce the winner on the next episode. Anyway, that is going to do it. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with another Fade Out before you know it. But until then, we've reached the end of this particular script. So it's time to fade out.
Beware of false prophets, which come to you in sheep's clothing, for inwardly they are ravening wolves.